The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the special report headline, Where Does Wealth Reside? North Carolina's Hottest Spots of Affluence. The Triangle area plays a big role. And that's the headline on the front page. The actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline, Our Hottest Spots of Affluence. And this is research by G. Scott Thomas. Our mission was daunting, sift through mounds of demographic data to identify America's most affluent places. Here's how we did it. We began with two vast pools. The first contained 14,995 U.S. cities, villages, boroughs, census-designated places, and most towns with populations above 1,000. The second encompassed 22,568 zip code territories. Two clarifications are needed immediately. CDPs are unincorporated areas determined by the U.S. Census Bureau to possess other characteristics of a city, and some towns were excluded because the Bureau considers towns and townships in several states, especially in New England, New York, and the Midwest, to be unincorporated for statistical purposes. Our goal was to go beyond a simple exploration of income, so our rankings also took into account home values and sizes, occupations, types of outside income, and education levels. In total, 12 statistical categories were analyzed based on the 5-year version of the U.S. Census Bureau's 2015 American Community Survey. Most of these categories detailed in this article are self-explanatory, but a few need further explanation. Income encompasses 42 sources of money, ranging from salaries and dividends to alimony and low-income energy assistance. The Census Bureau does not publish incomes above $250,000. If a place or zip code is above that threshold, it is listed at $250,001. Earnings are confined to wages, salaries, and self-employment income, a narrower definition than for income. An upper quartile house value exceeds 75% of all housing units in a given place. A median is higher than 50%. The Census Bureau does not report figures above $2 million for these two categories. If a place is above that threshold, it is listed at $2,001,000. Not all rooms are created equal. The Bureau does not count bathrooms, laundry rooms, utility rooms, walk-in closets, pantries, or unfinished rooms in the category of houses with 9 rooms or more. White-collar jobs, bureaucratically labeled as management, business, science, or arts occupations, include such jobs as CEOs, general managers, accountants, engineers, software developers, lawyers, scientists, doctors, medical specialists, and teachers. The percentage of adults with bachelor's and advanced degrees is limited to persons 25 or older. Positive scores were awarded for results above the national average in each category. Negative scores were given for performances below average. When all the results were tallied, the top places on our list exceeded 280 points, putting them in the stratosphere of American affluence. And there are a number of charts, graphs, and maps with this article. We'll read through the information in a few of them. 12 aspects of affluence. Money is at the very heart of affluence. That's why our 12-part formula includes such indicators as per capita income, median household income, earnings above $100,000, and poverty rate. But other factors must also be considered, such as education, employment, and housing. Listed below are the North Carolina leaders in the 12 categories with their overall national affluence ranks in parentheses. Out of 14,995 U.S. cities, villages, towns, boroughs, and related communities. Per capita income. Biltmore Forest, $83,403. That ranks 58 on the national list. St. James, $65,373, ranking of 841. And Bermuda Run, $58,269, a ranking of 1,043. Median household income, Marvin, $181,452, ranks number 36 on the national list. Biltmore Forest, $150,438, that ranks 58. And Weddington at $135,611, ranking at 515. For the rest of these, we'll read just the top winner in the state. Workers earning $100,000 or more, 45.6%, Marvin. Household income $150,000 or more, 59.8%, Marvin. Adults with bachelor's degrees, 81.1%, Biltmore Forest. Adults with advanced degrees, 44.7%, Chapel Hill. Poverty rate, 0.9%, North Lakes. Households with interest, dividends, or rental income, 74.6%, Farrington Village. Management, business, science, or arts jobs, 66.6%, Morrisville. Housing units with 9 rooms or more, Marvin, 78%. And for some of those locations, their national ranking, Chapel Hill, 1,277. North Lakes, 2,940. Farrington Village, 1,109. Morrisville, 1,364. And previously we mentioned Marvin at 308, Biltmore Forest at 58. Upper quartile home value, Biltmore Forest, $1,230,800. And median home value, also Biltmore Forest, $839,100. And here are some locations with their scores by zip code. Charlotte, the 28207 zip code, affluent score of 278. Cary, zip code 27519, score of 219. 27608 in Raleigh, a score of 210. 27518 in Cary, a score of 195. 27517 in Chapel Hill, a score of 190. 27614 in Raleigh, a score of 174. 28036 in Davidson, a score of 165. 28277, Charlotte, 162. And also in Charlotte, 28211, that zip code came in with a ranking of 159. And from the national ranking, we'll read the most affluent places in America. A few of the names to follow might be familiar, but many probably aren't. That's because affluence is often concentrated in small communities that are well known locally, yet are anonymous nationally. Everybody in the Washington, D.C. area, for example, is aware of Chevy Chase, Maryland. But move west across the country and that familiarity might wane. Similarly, residents of Chevy Chase might not be able to pinpoint Cherry Hills Village in Colorado or Bunker Hill Village in Texas. What these places have in common, though, are high scores in our affluence ranking. In fact, they are tightly bunched within 3 points of each other at the top of our scale. Number 1, Chevy Chase, Maryland, a town. Affluence score of 287.376. Number 2, Hunters Creek Village in Texas. Affluence score of 286.954. 3, the Village of Indian Hill, Ohio, 286.869. 4, Wolf Trap, Virginia, 286.532. 5, Dover, Massachusetts, 286.474. Number 6, Kenilworth, Illinois, 286.363. Number 6, also in a tie, Winnetka, Illinois, 286.363. Number 8, Ladue, Missouri, 286.292. Great Neck Estates, New York, at number 9, with a score of 286.287. And number 10 is Great Falls, Virginia, with a score of 286.278. And we have a short article concerning the national look. This is written by Mark Manesha. The headline, Searching for Wealth? Look big, then step back. Affluence resides near top population centers. If you're looking for the nation's most affluent communities, your search won't take you to the country's largest cities. You'll get close, though. American City Business Journal's exclusive ranking of America's most affluent communities reveals a top 25 list that features 8 locales within 20 miles of Washington, D.C. That list is led by Chevy Chase, Maryland, which can boast the title of the nation's most affluent community, according to our research. Wolf Trap, Virginia, and Great Falls, Virginia, also rank in the top 10. But the nation's capital is not alone in having surrounding pockets of wealth. Neighboring Chicago-area communities, Kenilworth and Winnetka, are tied for 6th in the ranking. Both lie about 20 miles north of the Windy City. 3 high-ranking communities also are found within miles of both New York City. Number 9, Great Neck Estates, New York. Number 10, Short Hills, New Jersey. And number 17, Scarsdale, New York. And Houston. Number 2, Hunter's Creek Village. Number 14, Bunker Hill Village. And number 15, West University Place. ACBJ's affluence ranking considers many of the variables that would be expected in a gauge of wealth: per capita income, median household income, and households with incomes of $150,000 or more. The assessment goes beyond mere dollars, though. Other factors in our 12-point assessment include home values, workers with management, business, science, or arts occupations, and the number of adults with bachelor's degrees and with advanced degrees. The idea that there's more to life than money? Our ranking is a reflection of that. The people who reside in these communities of affluence might not be working day to day in those cities and towns, but it's where they're building and buying homes, spending money, enrolling their children in schools, and raising their families when they're not at the office in Washington, D.C., or Chicago, or New York, as the case might be. It's why the corporate relocation business involves consideration of not only the city in which a company will be based, but also the surrounding cities where that company's employees very well might reside. Now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Old Irish vodka recipe heads to Hollywood, North Carolina shelves. A Durham company is looking to make a splash in Hollywood and on local shelves with a vodka derived from a rice-based recipe that dates back to the Irish potato famine. Greybeard Distillery CEO Brandon Evans says the ancestors of partner Scott Russ learned to make vodka from rice when potatoes were sparse in the 1840s. Now Evans says his company is trying to disrupt the vodka industry. The difference is when you have wheat or rye vodka, you get a harshness to it, Evans tells Biz. But the cool thing about rice vodka is there is little to no burn, and it's got a body to it, a hint of sweetness to it. What you get is something you can drink on the rocks by itself. Greybeard Distillery produces the vodka, which it calls Bedlam, at a facility in Durham and has an annual capacity of 110,000 cases. The vodka is getting into stores across North Carolina and garnering attention. At the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of America convention back in the spring in Orlando, Florida, Bedlam won the Hot New Now Media Award and also won the Brand Battle. Bedlam, meanwhile, captured the interest of ESPN, which will feature the vodka at a party on July 11, the night before the ESPY Awards in Los Angeles. Evans says he plans to have 100 cases of Bedlam at the party, which will have 1,000 people. Beyond that, Greybeard wants to distribute the vodka up and down the East Coast and beyond. Our goal, Evans says, is to grow quickly, but intelligently. Bio Moreau raises money for Rise Against Hunger, and this time the bosses take one for the team. French life sciences company Bio Moreau, which recently completed a $60 million expansion in Durham at Trayburn Corporate, found a creative way to help when it comes to ending hunger. The company raised money for the Raleigh-based global nonprofit Rise Against Hunger on June 30 with its Payback's a Pitch fundraiser that saw BioMerics employees dunk their bosses in a dunking booth and cream them with pies in their faces. So far, BioMaru has raised $3,500 this year for Rise Against Hunger. North Carolina is the best place to work. Entrepreneurs and business owners need look no further than the Tar Heel State to set up shop. North Carolina came out on top in a study of the best states to start a business. The study by Fit Small Business cited the state's labor market and taxes as driving an ideal environment for business owners. Fit Small Business out of New York City says it provides research to help small business owners make wiser decisions. Raleigh was ranked the best city in the state to start a business due to its labor market. The researchers used data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Kauffman Foundation, and the Small Business Administration to rank states on seven categories: access to capital, startup activity, taxes, cost of living, labor market, quality of life, and cost of starting a business. The study took corporate, individual income, unemployment insurance, property, and sales taxes into account, ranking North Carolina 11th nationally for tax rates. At 3%, North Carolina's corporate tax rate is the lowest of any state levying a corporate tax, according to the Tax Foundation. But those looking for venture capital investments and small business loans may turn their attention elsewhere. The state was ranked 34th in access to capital, while Utah, ranked as the second best state overall for starting a business, dominated the category. North Carolina's beach towns get overlooked. We're proud of our beaches here in North Carolina, and for good reason, but a website evaluating the best beach towns apparently is not impressed. WalletHub evaluated beach communities across the U.S. and ranked them according to best places to live. But of the 227 communities on the list, not a single North Carolina town made it. Naples, Florida was number one, and okay, we get that, but Eden Prairie, Minnesota, number 3, and Olathe, Kansas, number 20? Thanks, but here at Biz, we're perfectly happy at Nag's Head, or Atlantic Beach, or Wilmington, or Sunset Beach, or... Marinade called The Shizzle, ready to debut at Publix. Move over, Sweet Baby Ray's. A new sauce is taking over the shelf, or at least part of the shelf, now that the Raleigh food entrepreneur Austin Williams has landed a deal with Publix to begin selling his jerk seasoning marinade, The Shizzle, in all Publix stores across the Southeast. To put this deal in perspective, Williams' company, Big and Fine Food Company of Raleigh, has been producing an average of 8,000 jars per year that he has been selling at about 40 Whole Foods Market stores and a few other small retailers since 2011 and 2012. But to meet its first order for Publix, the company had to produce 20,000 jars, or the equivalent of 40% of its total production volume over the previous 6 years. We are thrilled to have this opportunity to grow with Publix, Williams says. Production for The Shizzle, which sells for about $8 per jar, is expected to exceed 80,000 jars in 2017. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "The investment itself that Alexandria is making indicates that we continue to be a vibrant and attractive place for high-tech agriculture. They would not be investing if they did not believe that." And that's from Scott Johnson, Vice President of Agricultural Biotechnology at the RTP-based NC Biotechnology Center, talking about a move by real estate developer Alexandria Real Estate Equities to develop a 1 million square foot multi-tenant plant science mega campus at what used to be Syngenta's headquarters. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Credit Suisse commits to big lease at GSK campus as part of RTP expansion. The new owners of the recently acquired GlaxoSmithKline office and research campus in Research Triangle Park have already landed their first big office tenant deal, even if it is short-term. Executives at Credit Suisse have signed a lease contract for close to 180,000 square feet of space in two office buildings on the former GSK campus, now called Parmer RTP, at 5 Moore Drive, company sources have confirmed. Credit Suisse in May announced it would be expanding its technology center in Research Triangle Park, with plans to invest $70.5 million in the construction of a new 200,000-square-foot office building. The building would be built to accommodate 1,200 new job positions. But new buildings take time to build, and Credit Suisse real estate team is in the early stages of planning. Company officials have said they plan to have the building, which will be built next to the company's existing office building on Louis Stevens Drive, ready for occupancy in 2019. In line with our announcement in May, Credit Suisse has leased temporary space at 5 Moore Drive in Durham County on a short-term basis while it continues to plan its development of a permanent real estate solution consisting of a new building. Credit Suisse spokesman Thomas Baer stated in an email. Baer did not detail lease terms of the contract. Credit Suisse Raleigh site lead, Jim Captain, says the company expects the space to be ready for employees in September, but recruitment for the new positions has begun. As of June 30, Credit Suisse had 140 job listings posted for its RTP operations. It now employs about 1,700 people in RTP. These North Carolina communities rank among top places for vacation homes. With demand for vacation homes on the rise across the country, Adam Data Solutions has released a report that ranks the best places for affordable alternatives for a summer vacation home. North Carolina has 3 cities in the top 10 and 8 cities overall listed among the top 100 communities evaluated. The report evaluated an index of 5 factors, including median sales price over the past 12 months, home price appreciation over the past 5 years, average temperatures from June to August, air quality and crime rates. It only evaluated cities where at least 7.7% of all prospective buyers over the last 12 months were looking for a second home. And the ranking is number 2, Waynesville. And I should mention these North Carolina communities rank among the best alternatives for summer vacation homes with ranking and year-to-date median home sale price values. So number 2, Waynesville, $195,000. Number 4, Asheville, $259,500. Number 5, Weaverville, $265,000. Number 40, Leland, $184,000. Number 58, Southport, $252,500. Number 80, Wilmington, $197,000. Number 84, Sneed's Ferry, $200,000. And number 91, Holly Ridge, $255,000. Brugger's Bagels at North Hills closes after lease not renewed. Regular patrons of the Brugger's Bagels and Cafe sitting between the two big office towers at North Hills were greeted last week with locked doors. North Hills developer John Kane of Kane Realty Corporation confirms that the Brugger's closed after he and his team decided not to renew its lease. "That's an important piece of real estate for us, and we decided we wanted to go a different direction." Kane says they are close to signing a deal with a replacement tenant that would be able to use the single-story building between the Bank of America Tower and the CapTrust Tower for both day and night activities, including its outdoor dining spaces. "But we're not quite ready to announce that yet," Kane says. Brugger's Bagels was one of the first retail tenants to open on the east side of North Hills when the CapTrust building opened in 2010. Walmart sees positive response to vending test. Inside the Walmart Supercenter on Main Street in Wake Forest stands a 16-foot robotic vending machine that, for now, is only one of 5 in the U.S. It's a new technology that Walmart Stores is testing to improve its online order pickup services for customers, and it's expected to be expanding soon. The machine's introduction into stores nationwide could also be an economic boom for Durham-based Bell & Howell, which has partnered with the European manufacturer of the machine and its 3D scanning technology. They call it the Pack Robot, and the technology is already being used in 800 locations across Europe. Wake Forest store manager Josh Hess says the reaction from customers so far has been positive, estimating that the machine is being used 20 to 50 times per day. And finally, Mommy Nori's plans large new location in Raleigh. The owners of the popular Peruvian-style chicken restaurant Mami Nori's on Wake Forest Road in Raleigh are within weeks, maybe days, from opening a second, much larger location for Mami Nora's on Glenwood Avenue. Co-owner Eddie Mentori, who runs the restaurant with his mother, Selena, says most of the renovations for the new 9,300-square-foot restaurant are complete. The new location is located in the old Blinko's Sports Bar at Durali Road. They're waiting on the city inspectors to give their final seal of approval. We're waiting, he says. We just don't know when it will be. Now we turn to On Tech and Transportation, written by Lauren Onasorge. RDU seeking more direct flights to the West Coast. 5 years ago, Raleigh-Durham International Airport got its inaugural nonstop flight to San Francisco International Airport, SFO. Today, that flight, along with Los Angeles and Seattle, is one of three West Coast routes at the airport, and the list could be expanding as RDU has earmarked San Diego, San Jose, California, and Portland, Oregon as three of its top five unserved markets. While San Diego tops RDU's list in terms of the number of passengers already trekking between the two cities each day, the Triangle's growing entrepreneurship community has a different target, San Jose. Even without a nonstop flight, airport statistics show 87 passengers fly between RDU and Norman Y. Mineta San Jose International Airport, SJC, each day. Real travel numbers are likely higher as entrepreneurs often take the existing United Airlines service to SFO before hopping a ride to Silicon Valley. Even so, it's fourth on RDU's list of unserved markets, and the feeling is mutual. Vicky Day, spokeswoman for SJC, says RDU ranked third on its list in 2016. We do have continuing dialogue with multiple airlines that could potentially serve the route in the future, she wrote in an email. For entrepreneurs, it comes down to convenience, something investors value too, says Jason Kaplan, co-founder of Bull City Venture Partners. That could mean increasing the frequency of flights back and forth to SFO, or it could mean adding San Jose, he says. Mike Walden, economist and professor at NC State University, says an SJC addition would be huge for the business community, whether it's an entrepreneur or an employee at a mega technology firm such as IBM or NetApp. It's about an hour driving time between SFO and SJC, he notes. That's too big to busy professionals. RDU recently approved an incentives program aimed at securing nonstops to unserved locations. Solar-powered benches to help people in Raleigh juice up their cell phones. Phone out of juice in downtown Raleigh? That's where a new investment by the City of Raleigh can help. Three solar-powered benches complete with USB plugs. Specifically, they're called SOOFA benches, spelled S-O-O-F-A. And they're the brainchild of a female engineer-founded Massachusetts Institute of Technology startup, SOOFA. But Sandra Richter, CEO and co-founder of the Massachusetts-based firm, says the technology does more than charge smartphones and tablets. We think about people first, she says. So a simple thing like a solar-powered bench can actually give an opportunity for people to meet serendipitously. It's kind of a people-focused technology. Richter calls the partnership with the city an amazing use case for us. North Carolina is one of our focus areas, she says. It's a place where there is a lot happening. The city is installing three of the solar-powered cell phone charging benches. They'll feature two USB plug-ins that use solar power to charge cell phones, available on a first-come, first-served basis. And they'll also collect data for the city. Sensors in the benches will monitor activity in the surrounding area so officials can see in real time how people are using them. The first charging station is up and running in Exchange Plaza, with the second targeted for nearby Market Plaza. Apex Clean Energy may suspend North Carolina wind project. Virginia's Apex Clean Energy, which is planning a 105-turbine project in North Carolina, is preparing for the ramifications of a new wind moratorium in North Carolina. Spokesman Kevin Chandler said in an email, an 18-month delay coupled with the near certainty of additional red tape means We will almost certainly have to suspend Timber Mill Wind if House Bill 589 becomes law. Timber Mill Wind, the project plan for Perkwamins and Chowan counties, was to be the state's second utility-scale wind farm. It's unfortunate that a small number of elected officials were able to hijack what should have been a bright moment for clean energy in North Carolina, Chandler wrote. A group of legislators have repeatedly tried to pass wind moratoriums and regulations that would add additional scrutiny to project approvals. The latest attempt by Senator Harry Brown, Republican of Jones and Onslow, was to add the wind moratorium language to an existing energy bill, a compromise measure Duke Energy had reached with the solar industry. Until last week, it didn't include any language at all involving wind energy. In an evening committee, Brown added an addendum calling for a moratorium while research was conducted on wind farms' impact to military operations in the state. And it passed both House and Senate votes prior to the July 4th holiday weekend at the end of the session. Brown hasn't responded to multiple requests for comment. Now we have a section called They Said It, which is actually related to the story concerning RDU seeking more direct flights to the West Coast. The first quote is from Tony Addy, CEO of Durham's Phononic. If there was a direct flight to San Jose as well as SFO, I could arrive early a.m. and get a full day in the valley for meetings regardless of location, whereas right now I typically get only half a day. And from David Rose, co-founder of Personas in Durham, I don't fly to SJC, but would like to since the flights to that airport are often cheaper. And finally, Justin Miller, CEO of WedPix in Raleigh. The biggest gripe for me is having options available and not just a monopoly of flights. And also in another He Said It column, we have a quote. I did an e-blast out to about 1,200 people, decision makers in the industry. The response has been good. And that's from Bill Vassar, Executive Vice President of EUE Screen Gem Studio, days after the state again approved a recurring film grant to lure Hollywood producers to shoot their projects in North Carolina. Right now, TNT drama Good Behavior is the only production scheduled to shoot at his Wilmington studio, which has previously hosted projects such as Dawson's Creek and Under the Dome. And now on the Life Sciences page, written by Jennifer Henderson. In case of sale, Sempra execs primed for golden parachutes. Chapel Hill-based Sempra, which has struggled to regain footing after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration did not approve its pneumonia drug, clarithromycin, in December of last year, has disclosed in an SEC filing that, should a sale of the company ensue, its acting CEO and other C-suite executives are primed for golden parachutes. The company has entered into a change-in-control severance agreement with Dr. David Zaccardelli, acting CEO, and into an amended change-in-control severance agreement with Chief Financial Officer Mark Hahn, Chief Medical Officer Dr. David Oldock, and Executive Vice President of Investor Relations and Corporate Communications John Bluth. The severance agreements are intended to provide an incentive to our executive officers to remain with our company before and after any transaction we might pursue, Sempra said in the filing. We believe that retaining the knowledge and expertise of our current executive officers, particularly related to clarithromycin and our other product candidates and their related clinical trials, is and will be critical to maintaining the value of our company's assets, both while we explore business opportunities and after any such transaction that we might undertake. Zaccardelli assumed the role of acting CEO of Sempra in December. Innovate Biopharma lands deal with California firm. Raleigh-based Innovate Biopharmaceuticals reverse merger with Simi Valley, California-based Monster Digital is moving forward. After detailing its plans to become a public company earlier this month, Innovate said July 3 that it has inked its reverse merger agreement with Monster Digital. The deal, expected to close later this year, will result in a combined company to be called Innovate Biopharmaceuticals that will be led by Innovate's management team. In an interview earlier this month, Innovate's Director of Operations and Investor Relations, Kendall Woodard, said the benefit of a reverse merger is twofold in that it's less expensive and takes less time than an IPO. Operating as a public company also gives Innovate greater access to capital, which is expected to aid in moving its pipeline forward. In particular, Woodward said, lorazepam acetate for the treatment of celiac disease. Moving into phase 3 trials, Innovate expects approval of lorazepam acetate by early 2020, Innovate President Jay Mandin says. Millions at stake in healthcare dispute. The legal wrangling continues between an Eastern North Carolina firm and several state entities with millions of dollars at stake. Following the dismissal of its lawsuit filed in federal court earlier this month, East Point Human Services was granted a request for a temporary restraining order halting Nash County's disengagement from East Point that was scheduled to take effect July 1. But following a hearing in state court July 3, the battle continues. East Point, a Beulahville-based firm that manages behavioral health services in 12 North Carolina counties, filed suit June 8 against the NC Department of Health and Human Services, as well as Trillium Health Resources in Nash County. Ignoring their clear obligations under state and federal law, NCDHHS, Trillium, and Nash County are poised to consummate the unlawful disengagement of Nash County from East Point and the reallocation of approximately $30 million annually from East Point to Trillium, East Point stated in its complaint in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina. That lawsuit was dismissed in federal court, quote, for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, unquote, on June 29. The temporary restraining order was granted the next day. Defendants and plaintiff shall maintain the status quo with respect to the contracts existing as of June 30, 2017, among East Point and Nash County, East Point and DHHS Division of Mental Health, and East Point and the DHHS Division of Medical Assistance, pending further orders of the court, stated the order signed by Superior Court Judge Douglas Parsons. The judge made the right decision June 30, stated Sarah Stroud, CEO of East Point. Now we'll have the opportunity to make our arguments to ensure the law is followed while our members continue to receive care seamlessly. But defendants in the case filed a motion to dismiss the temporary restraining order, and there was a hearing July 3. D. Whitley of Battle, Winslow, Scott, and Wiley in Rocky Mount, representing Nash County, said that a different state court judge dissolved the temporary restraining order. There will be an additional hearing July 11, he said, as to whether East Point will prevail in terms of obtaining a preliminary injunction. Belgian Pharma eyes Canadian approval after staffing up in Durham. Belgian pharmaceutical company Promethera Biosciences SA has its sights set on Canadian approval after bulking up in Durham. Promethera announced July 3 that Health Canada has accepted the company's new drug submission for Heparesk, which it gained through its acquisition of key assets from Cytonet just last year, for review in neonatal onset urea cycle disorders. UCDs are rare genetic disorders that cause toxic ammonia levels. At the time that Promethera's acquisition of Cytonet was announced in April 2016, Promethera said, adding the advanced pre-commercial stage product candidate Heparesk to the Promethera product portfolio will enable early commercialization. This is targeted for 2017 through a Canadian market approval process and recognition by other countries. Promethera further stated that the acquisition added a U.S. outpost in Durham with an 18-person team. According to the company spokesman, facilities in Durham include commercial operations and GMP manufacturing facilities, as well as organ procurement. Oyster Bar involved in lawsuit. Shuck and Shack Franchising LLC, which offers Shuck and Shack Oyster Bar franchises in North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Maryland, is suing a pair of franchisees over their opening of a similar oyster bar in Fletcher, North Carolina. Shuck and Shack alleges in a complaint now in federal court that the opening of the Shuck and Brew Oyster Bar in Fletcher, south of Asheville, in June amounts to trademark and trade dress infringement as well as misappropriation of trade secrets. Anthony Biller, a Cary attorney representing the defendant, says his clients were disappointed by the actions the plaintiff took instead of trying to discuss the issues. He says his clients will be reopening Shuck and Brew Oyster Bar in Fletcher July 6 as Surf and Brew. He further says that there are significant franchise issues that need to be resolved. Pricing pressures continue for life sciences companies. Panelist Doug Edgerton, president and CEO of the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, and Mike Leary, managing partner at Clarkston Consulting, talked about funding, innovation, and repatriation at Triangle Business Journal's inaugural Life Sciences Live event on the morning of June 22 at the frontier of Research Triangle Park. When it comes to the biggest challenge currently facing Triangle Life Sciences companies, Leary said that it's certainly pricing pressures with, on average, roughly $2.6 billion and about 10 years or more needed to bring a product to market. It creates incentives to recoup that investment, he said, noting that there's need for some transparency to the public that it's not just price gouging. There is an inefficient use of capital throughout the life cycle of a product, he said. We need to streamline that and make it more effective. A second point Leary noted is the challenge of making a transition into the digital age. With a movement from rewarding for outcomes rather than quantity, substantial responsibility still sits with patients, he said, when it comes to following prescribed regimens for medications, for instance. How do you take a life sciences company with innovative skills around research and development of products and combine it with a partnership with somebody about how to engage patients, how to create technology, how to create applications? To me, that's the big challenge. He said medical device companies, particularly in the diabetes space, have been active in this area when it comes to wearables. As for Edgerton, he said the biggest challenge he sees for Triangle Life Sciences companies is securing their first $1 million in funding. Programs we do at the Biotech Center are designed to help fill some of those gaps, but that money is scarce in North Carolina. It's hard to come by, he said, as opposed to markets such as Boston and San Francisco. And we're fractions of the cost of being there. The talent piece is very well covered here, but I think the money piece is much easier to find in those markets. As for potential regulatory impacts, locally based life sciences companies may want to keep their eyes on issues related to the new presidential administration. Innovation and repatriation are key factors at play here, according to the panelists. While the healthcare bill is up in the air, Edgerton noted that later this year, legislation regarding repatriating money held offshore could certainly present an opportunity for the life sciences field. Capital investments that have not occurred in the U.S. because they didn't want to bring the money in and pay a 35% tax rate on it have been occurring around the world, Edgerton said. The life sciences industry is estimated to have $250 billion sitting offshore that they would bring back in if this opportunity occurred. Leary said life sciences companies should be looking for potential efficiency developments that may be put forward by the Trump administration when it comes to bringing products to market. With China leading the way in the first clinical trials for CRISPR, a revolutionary gene editing technology, he noted, the U.S. needs to be able to compete differently and find a way to get creative, he says. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, where first we'll read a column written by Andrew Broad, who's a senior research fellow in UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. The headline, Cutting Retiree Benefits is Not the Solution. The North Carolina General Assembly passed its budget in the past couple of weeks. The governor vetoed it after both chambers approved it, but the General Assembly overrode the veto and the budget will now become law. There are many surprises in the budget. One is a provision to eliminate retiree health benefits for state workers. Starting in 2021, people hired by the state will no longer receive health benefits after they retire. Currently, retirees receive health insurance until they're eligible for Medicare, at which point the state provides a Medicare supplement. It's a good deal. The GA has two rationales for the change. First, these benefits cost about $900 million per year, and the GA needs spending cuts to pay for its numerous tax cuts. Second, the GA believes that state benefits are too generous and should be reduced to be more in line with the private sector. Let's focus on the second rationale. It's backwards. Benefits for state employees should not be in line with private sector benefits, at least not if we want high-quality people to work for the state as teachers, analysts, and managers. State employees are, on average, more highly educated than workers in the private sector. After all, about a third of all state government workers are teachers and professors. When we take skills into account, state employees are paid less than their counterparts in the private sector. Fringe benefits help offset that disadvantage. I'm a current retiree, so this won't affect me at all. This is about our future. Cutting benefits will make state employment less attractive. It's hard to imagine why anyone would find that a desirable outcome. We need state workers to perform important services. They teach our children, protect our homes, maintain our roads, and so on. For example, we hear that the skill and education of our workforce must improve if we're to remain competitive in the national and world economies. How will that happen if we effectively drive would-be teachers into other professions and to other states? This budget provision isn't the first time the GA has whittled away at retiree health benefits. In 2011, a new law required retirees to pay a premium for the more generous health insurance plan after decades in which the plan was free to retirees. A group of retirees led by former State Chief Justice I. Beverly Lake has sued the state for breaking its contract with retirees. Unlike the current budget provision, this one affects me personally, and I'm rooting for the plaintiffs. However, this also affects future state workers. The retirees have a good case. It's one thing to start charging a premium to current employees. If they don't like it, they can find another job. But retirees can't go and become retirees of Duke Energy or the state of Tennessee. We're stuck. Earlier this year, a trial judge ruled for the retirees. If the ruling stands, then by one estimate, the state will have to pony up more than $100 million in compensation. The state health plan has been underfunded in recent years, but cutting or charging for retiree benefits isn't the solution. In an increasingly complex society, we rely on government services and need them to be done well. And that means persuading smart and talented people to take state jobs. If the state doesn't pay them as much as private employers do, then it must offer better benefits. And also in a guest opinion, we have a column written by John Hood, who is chairman of the John Locke Foundation, and the subject on his guest opinion column, Subject Mastery Test, Best Option in Improving Teaching Measures. While there is no shortage of opinions and controversy about how best to improve schooling, virtually everyone agrees that the quality of teaching is the critical variable. To improve schooling is only to contribute to the future success of students, not to guarantee it. Formal education is only one influence on child development. Kids who grow up in single-parent families, in poverty, and in unsafe neighborhoods, conditions that are highly correlated with each other, by the way, have disadvantages that won't necessarily be dispelled by access to good schools. That's no argument for inaction, however, or for changing the focus to policy issues other than education. For example, government policy may have played a role in disrupting the traditional two-parent family, as conservatives persuasively argue, but it's far from clear what government policies could reverse the damage. The same constraint doesn't apply to education. There is an emerging body of compelling empirical evidence suggesting that teacher quality significantly affects student performance and that certain qualities or policies are more likely than others to improve the quality of teaching. In a new paper published in the Journal of Economic Surveys, a team of Dutch scholars analyzed the academic research on teacher quality conducted since the 1970s by researchers across the developed world. The authors picked only high-quality studies, including those with inadequate statistical controls or, excluding those with inadequate statistical controls or other defects. Then they summarized the results. One of them will be familiar to readers of this column. Teachers with graduate degrees are no more effective than teachers without them. This is one of the most replicated findings in modern education research, which makes it all the more outrageous when the North Carolina legislature is attacked for getting rid of teacher bonuses for acquiring graduate degrees. Naturally, there were clear beneficiaries from the practice, which was in place for decades before the General Assembly ended it in 2013. Most of them worked in North Carolina schools of education. Paying teachers to get degrees produced a steady stream of revenue to these schools, even as it produced no detectable improvement in student learning, because most of the advanced degree teachers acquired were in education, not in particular subjects. When it comes to teacher experience, most studies find a link to effectiveness, but it's not necessarily a linear relationship. That is, the relationship can't be depicted with a straight line on a graph. The Dutch team concluded that most studies find significant learning gains for the first couple of years of experience, but hardly any later on in the teacher's career, although there are a few counterexamples in the literature. What does appear to matter then? Based on the studies to date, the subject matter knowledge of teachers, their performance while in college, and the rigor of the colleges they attend are important considerations. North Carolina policymakers should structure our recruitment, compensation, and retention policies accordingly. All of which assumes, perhaps unrealistically, that we can debate the issue of teacher quality on the basis of evidence, not politics or special interest pleading. And now we'll turn to some news from across the state. Richard Petty's business empire still rolling along in Level Cross. Richard Petty turned 80 on July 2. The Southern motorsports icon is 25 years removed from his last NASCAR victory. Despite the passage of time, much about Petty remains the same. He's still razor-thin and is seldom seen without his trademark sunglasses and cowboy hat. His name is as synonymous as ever with vehicles that go fast. But there are differences. His operation in Level Cross is now Petty's Garage, not Petty Enterprises, and its function, while still linked to motor vehicles, has no direct ties to NASCAR. Petty's Garage is a performance speed shop, a place where employees work all kinds of magic on any number of rides, upgrades that include superchargers, custom projects, and complete restorations. They all leave the ground with a stamp of approval of Petty, that's RP, to the 70 or so in his employ, all bearing modifications and newfound muscle and all capable of getting from here to there in a big hurry. As the garage's website puts it, if you can dream it, we can build it. We usually start with either rust buckets or brand new cars, is how Petty described the vehicles that come into his shop, and rides leave with anything as complex as a frame-off restoration or as simple as a new exhaust system. The change from a business that focused on racing to one that customizes cars took place after Petty had moved his NASCAR operation to Mooresville in 2008 to be closer to the Charlotte Motor Speedway. Petty's Garage was formed 8 years ago, while the Richard Petty Museum dates back to 1993. The racing portion of the business is now Richard Petty Motorsports, or RPM for short, a venture of which Petty remains a co-owner and that Forbes lists as NASCAR's eighth most valuable race team with an estimated value of $48 million. The famed number 43 racer is now driven by Eric Almirola, though his accident in May in Kansas meant that RPM enlisted racer Billy Johnson to drive the number 43 at Sonoma Raceway, finishing number 22 in his NASCAR Cup debut. Massive River Bend project rising near Charlotte. A huge mixed-use project off Interstate 485 and Mount Holly-Huntersville Road near Charlotte will soon go vertical. Simpson Commercial Real Estate out of Greensboro and Charlotte-based Landmark Development Partners are partnering on River Bend Village. That 120-acre project will include a 78,000-square-foot Harris Teeter grocery anchor, 330,000 square feet of retail, and more than 500 residential units. The project will serve as home for Corning Optical Communications, which is expected to invest $38 million in its new headquarters at Riverbend Village. Last year, Mecklenburg County Commissioners approved $750,000 in corporate incentives to Corning, which plans to employ 650 at the Riverbend Village office. Triad roadwork aimed at easing urban traffic. State transportation officials recently unveiled a 10-year report that includes several new projects in the Triad and plans to accelerate sections of the Greensboro and Winston-Salem urban loops. In Winston-Salem, construction of a 3-mile section of the western section of the Northern Beltway will be accelerated by 3 years, said Pat Ivey, division engineer for NCDOT. He said the project from Rinalda Road to west of US 52, future I-74, was originally slated to begin in 2024 and now will begin in 2021. The Greensboro Urban Loop will see a section between Lawndale Avenue to US 29 advanced by 1 year. The Greensboro Loop is expected to be complete in 2022 or 2023. And finally, in the Triangle Business Journal, in the People on the Move section, the spotlight is on Craig Cadwallader, VP Capital Markets for Multifamily Division at Avison Young. Armed with nearly 2 decades of commercial real estate experience, Craig Cadwallader has been tapped as Vice President of Capital Markets in the Multifamily Division of Avison Young in the Triangle and North Carolina. The Raleigh native is coming off a 10-year stint at Tribridge Residential that culminated with the role of Regional Portfolio Manager for the Triangle. There, he was charged with supporting the operations of a portfolio of multifamily assets across the state and throughout the Southeast. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.